works on the social determinants of HIV among drug users, and the social determinants of racial and ethnic disparities in HIV. Hannah will be presenting a case study assessing the impacts of public housing relocations on relocators' sexual health.
Well, thank you for that great introduction, and good morning to all of you. It's such a pleasure to be here. Katie has just provided us with a really lovely overview of the social determinants of STIs and of disparities in STIs. I'm going to focus in on the implications of one particular social factor, namely public housing policies for STIs. But before I start, I'd like to recognize my wonderful colleagues on this project. I'm going to open with a brief overview of some of the recent changes in public housing policy in the U.S. I'll keep it brief. You could be here all day, but I know you guys have better things to do. And then I'll talk about the methods and findings of a study about public housing policies and sexual health that was conducted here in Atlanta. And I'll close with some reflections. We are living through a paradigm shift in U.S. public housing policy. So back in the 1950s and 1960s, federal and local public housing authorities actively sought to spatially concentrate public housing units into high-rises and campuses. These policies, and in fact these buildings, helped to create very high concentrations of poverty in many U.S. cities. Starting in the 1980s, there was growing concern from many different sectors about the consequences of these complexes. Some were concerned about the impacts of concentrated poverty on public housing residents themselves and also on their neighbors. Additionally, some complexes began to fall into disrepair in the absence of federal funding to maintain them, and this raised concerns as well. Additionally, elected officials and real estate developers worried that these complexes obstructed their efforts to gentrify urban communities. In response to these concerns, Congress convened the National Commission on Severely Distressed Public Housing. This commission concluded that conditions in severely distressed public housing complexes were intolerable and that these complexes had to be eradicated. This commission also developed a definition of what severely distressed complexes were, and they actually are areas or complexes that have unusually high rates of unemployment, poverty, or violent crime, or that have high levels of physical dilapidation. Several new policies were developed in response to this report, including Moving to Opportunity and the HOPE 6 project. And some of you may actually be familiar with these housing policies. These policies were usually designed to achieve some combination of replacing or rehabilitating severely distressed complexes, revitalizing the surrounding neighborhoods, and decreasing the concentration of very low-income families, often by moving residents from distressed complexes to voucher-subsidized housing units in the private market. So this might be through Section 8 or through the Housing Choice Voucher Program. The Urban Institute has done some great research with households that are relocating via HOPE 6 nationally, and they have found that in the main, people tend to move to areas that are less impoverished and also less violent than the neighborhoods that surrounded their original public housing complex. The new neighborhoods also tend to have less drug activity. So what is the relevance of all this to disparities in STIs? So first, research suggests that neighborhood characteristics influence sexual risk behaviors in STIs. And in particular, it suggests that local poverty rates, violent crime rates, and drug activity influence these outcomes. And these are, of course, three of the neighborhood characteristics that relocations appear to affect. Second, studies have found that public housing relocations have broad effects on the physical and mental health of relocators, including on their rates of obesity, of severe diabetes, depression, and substance misuse. To date, though, no research has explored the impact of relocations on adult sexual health. Finally, severely distressed public housing itself and policies designed to eradicate it disproportionately affect African American and Latino households. While most people in the U.S. who are receiving public housing assistance are white, the vast majority of residents of severely distressed public housing complexes are African American or Latino. So for example, 90% of the families that are relocated via HOPE 6 nationally are African American or Latino. And I'm happy to talk about the processes that led to that particular racial ethnic profile during the question and answer session. So in light of all this, my colleagues and I designed a study to learn whether post-relocation changes in neighborhood characteristics were associated with sexual risk outcomes, substance misuse, and depression over time in a cohort of adult African-American relocators here in Atlanta, Georgia. And today, of course, I'll be focusing on sexual health outcomes. Atlanta has been at the forefront of efforts to eradicate severely distressed public housing. We started shortly after the release of that congressional report in the early 1990s. Can anyone imagine why we wanted to get a jump start on eradicating severely distressed public housing in the early? Thank you. Exactly. Yes. So several of the 1996 Olympic facilities were built on the footprints of the demolished public housing complexes. Since then, about 50,000 Atlantans have been relocated from public housing complexes through HOPE 6 and other relocation initiatives. These relocations have occurred in several cycles or several rounds. This study focuses on the final round of relocations, which occurred in Atlanta, and these targeted 7 severely distressed complexes between 2008 and 2010. All relocators received housing choice vouchers to find new housing in rental units in the private market. These were dispersed across the city, and complexes were demolished once they had been emptied. This is a longitudinal study in which we're gathering 7 waves of data. I'll be presenting findings from waves 1 through 4 today. Wave 1 was gathered before people relocated, so everyone's living in the public housing complexes at baseline. Wave 2 was gathered about 9 months after baseline, after the whole cohort had moved into the rental units. Waves 3 and 4 were gathered every 9 months thereafter. To be eligible to take part in the study, participants had to live in one of the 7 complexes targeted for relocation, and they had to be an African-American adult who had been sexually active in the past year. The broader study was designed to explore substance misuse trajectories over time, and so we used quota sampling methods to create a cohort that was varied with regard to recent substance misuse at baseline. We assessed individual-level characteristics at each wave using surveys and also biospecimens. So to assess STI status, we tested participants' urine for gonorrhea, chlamydia, and trichomonas at each wave. Participants who tested positive were referred to treatment. We used surveys to measure 2 other outcomes at each wave, perceived indirect concurrency and perceived partner risk. Indirect concurrency refers to having a partner who has another partner simultaneously. Perceived partner risk was an index that combined several items concerning partner risk, including whether the participant's partner had ever injected drugs, was currently using illegal drugs, and had a history of incarceration. We also assessed several census tract characteristics. Participant home addresses were geocoded or linked census tracts at each wave. We drew on several administrative databases to assess economic disadvantage, social disorder, and male-female sex ratios in each participant's census tract at each wave. The economic disadvantage measure was a compilation of data on tract-level poverty rates, median household income, and graduation rates from high school. The social disorder measure was a compilation of data, census tract level data, on alcohol outlet density and also on violent crime rates. Now, I haven't mentioned sex ratios before, but they capture the number of men for every 100 women in a particular geographic area, here census tracts. And areas that have fewer men than women tend to have higher prevalences of STIs and of sexual risk behavior. We used multi-level models to test associations between changes in tract-level exposures and each outcome. 172 people enrolled in the study. More than half were women, and the average age was 43. The sample was deeply impoverished at baseline, with about two-thirds of participants earning less than $10,000 in the prior year. We didn't see much post-relocation improvements in incomes in this cohort, and that's consistent with the experiences of other relocating cohorts in the U.S. Unfortunately, people's economic status doesn't seem to improve post-relocation. We do, though, see marked post-relocation declines in STIs and sexual risk. So at baseline, before the relocations, about 30% of the sample tested positive for an STI. This dropped to 19% at wave two and remained pretty stable thereafter. Similarly, we see that levels of perceived partner risk and indirect concurrency are high before people move and decline post-relocation. Now, this table depicts characteristics of the census tracts where participants lived at each wave. People moved, on average, about 5 miles between wave one and wave two, and these moves often took participants to census tracts or to neighborhoods that were qualitatively different from the neighborhoods where they started out. So, for example, the average poverty rate in the census tract where people started at baseline was 46%. At wave two, post-relocation, the average poverty rate was 29%. So that's still very high, but it's 17 percentage points lower than it was at baseline. This improvement was sustained over time. You see a similar pattern for other tract level characteristics, so high levels of economic disadvantage and social disorder before people move, followed by a sustained post-relocation improvement. I want to note that the average tract level sex ratio, which you can see at the bottom row, is pretty static across time at about 90 men for every 100 women. There was, though, considerable variation around this average in the sample, and so we could still analyze it as a predictor. This table depicts the results of three different multi-level models. So the results of a model predicting STI status can be seen in the left-hand column. The results of a model predicting indirect concurrency can be seen in the middle column, and the results of a model predicting perceived partner risk can be seen in the right-hand column. What we found is that members of the cohort who moved to census tracts with more equitable sex ratios had a lower odds of testing positive for an STI than members of the cohort who moved to census tracts with lower sex ratios. We also found that members of the cohort who experienced greater reductions in violent crime rates were less likely to report indirect concurrency. So people who moved to safer neighborhoods were less likely to report indirect concurrency. Finally, there was a trend such that participants who experienced greater improvements in economic conditions appeared to have lower risk partner scores over time. So just to summarize some of the main findings, in this sample, there were post-relocation improvements in all health outcomes and all health behaviors studied. Overall, post-relocation improvements in these outcomes were greater among people who experienced larger gains in local economic conditions and social disorder, and for people who moved to areas with more equitable sex ratios. A key next step for us for this study will be to try to understand the mechanisms through which changes in neighborhood conditions relate to sexual health outcomes and behaviors. We know from other analyses with this cohort that people experience post-relocation declines in substance misuse and also depression, so we'll look at whether those two changes might mediate some of the relationships seen here between neighborhood characteristics and sexual health. We'll also be exploring the roles of sexual and social networks. I want to be clear about some of the limitations of this study. So we could not randomly sample residents from the public housing complexes at baseline. One reason for this is that there was no inventory of residents by substance misuse status, and thank God there wasn't. I do want to note, though, that we compared characteristics of our sample with HUD data on characteristics of the underlying resident population in each complex, and we found that they're actually very similar. We also had no comparison group. The seven complexes targeted in the last wave were the last remaining severely distressed complexes in the city of Atlanta. So it's possible that the declines that we actually see in our sample are simply kind of declines that happened citywide. We actually have analyzed data on reportable STIs during the study period, and it doesn't seem that there's this kind of steep decline. Finally, we could not randomize relocators to neighborhoods. This was a natural experiment or a quasi-experimental design. It's possible, then, that lower-risk relocators chose to move to less poor or less violent neighborhoods. We have, though, examined whether people who had STIs at baseline or who had partners who had other partners, whether they were more likely to move to areas that were poorer or were more violent post-relocation, and we don't actually see that. We also have some strengths, I think. So this is a longitudinal study, and that means that we actually can ascertain the causal order between exposures and outcomes. We had a high retention rate, and we were also able to triangulate findings across biospecimen measures of STIs and self-reported measures of sexual behavior. For me, though, the most important strength that we have in this study is that we actually were focusing on a social policy as our exposure. This has allowed us to, I think, share findings more directly with the local public housing authority. They've actually shared our findings with HUD. And I think when you study a social policy as your exposure, you can interface with governments more easily, and then I think you have more of an impact, right, on the policies that may shape health. I don't think we study social policies enough in research on the social determinants of health, and I think that that's limited us. And just some closing thoughts. Public housing policies continue to evolve under the Obama administration, and we know that some policies appear to affect the public's health, and that raises a couple of questions for me. So first, how can public health departments and researchers be involved in determining the direction of these policies so that they promote health, or at least so that they don't harm health? And second, how can we build more powerful coalitions to affect social policies? And Dan has got some great thoughts on these that he'll share in a second. Before I turn the mic over to him, I want to acknowledge my great colleagues up on the stage, and then our study participants, funders, and the Atlanta Housing Authority. Thanks so much.